we had this idea that we could apply some like ways of measuring how the brain as a whole works. The musician's brain is like, wah, right? Whereas a regular person's is just, wah. What if that information was not just driven by what's outside them, but what's inside them? How well they're seeing targets right now, and how salient you have to make a target look or whatever.
Welcome to The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sanisbert of the Mad Scientist team, and I'll be joined in just a moment by Luke Shapiro, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the future of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can connect with us through Twitter at @ArmyMadSci or subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. On today's episode, we're talking with Jason Sherwin, CEO and co-founder of DeServo, a company that blends gaming and science to help you make the best decisions in high-stakes and complex environments. We'll be talking with Jason about the science behind quick decision-making, how he developed his technology with professional athletes, and the potential for it to help Army soldiers. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started. Jason, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Matt.
You and your company, DeServo, were profiled quite extensively in the book, The Performance Cortex, How Neuroscience is Redefining Athletic Genius by Zach Schoenbrunn. We had Zach on the show not that long ago, and he gave a great overview of his interactions with you and your company, you know, from his point of view. Can you tell us, though, a little bit about the history of DeServo, why you started it, what it does, and how you got to where you are now?
Sure. Yeah. And again, thanks for having me on. Whenever I hear the subtitle, you know, of Zach's book, Redefining Athletic Genius, I always think of this movie Airplane. It's a funny scene. It's a really funny movie from the 70s. And there's this scene with a stewardess walking down the aisle, giving out magazines. It's in the days when they would like give out magazines to give you something to do on the plane. And stewardess is backing down the aisle with a bunch of magazines in her arms. And she reaches an aisle with a row with an older lady on the edge. And the older lady says, stewardess, do you have any light reading? And the stewardess like kind of combs through the stack of magazines, and she pulls out this little piece of paper. She gives it to the old lady, and she says, how about this leaflet on great Jews and sports? So I always think of, you know, it's like, okay, Zach, me, Jordan, my partner on DeServo, it took like three Jewish kids to have to redefine what it meant to be an athletic genius, because for sure as hell, we were not athletic geniuses physically. And so, you know, that's like why, you know, we had to say like, what makes Michael Jordan amazing? What makes LeBron James amazing, right? What makes today Aaron Judge, you know, amazing? Knowing that the three of us didn't have that. And but, you know, we were still interested by, you know, how athletics happen, how athletes, like great athletes, occur. You know, so Jordan and I, my partner on DeServo, we met a long time ago, 2011, at a lab at Columbia University. So I was coming from outside of neuroscience. We were in a lab at Columbia that's run by really a visionary, I think, in the field. He doesn't get enough credit for it, I think, is Paul Scheide. Paul is running a lab at Columbia in the neuroscience, kind of an overlap between neuroscience and computer engineering. And at this lab, they were studying at the time quick decision making. And, you know, how that works is, you know, in terms of running experiments, it works in terms of like showing simple stimuli to people and measuring the response or imaging the response. So like green dot versus red dot, or, you know, hearing beeps versus boops. And so it's a series of attempts to image the brain as it's making decisions on very simple things, because that's the easiest way to measure how the brain is doing stuff. And I was coming from, my PhD had been in aerospace engineering, totally different context at Georgia Tech. And I didn't really know anything about neuroscience. I started taking a turn towards it in my thesis topic. And so as I started learning more about it from engaging in the research, I realized I don't really know where I'm what I'm doing here. So I leaned on the things I did know more of, which were music. I come from a music background. But, you know, I was seeing these experiments we were doing in the lab. You see a green dot, green dot, green dot, red dot, green dot, green dot, red dot. Or you hear beep, 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 boop, beep, beep, boop, beep, right? And we look at what the brain image looks like when you see the red dot versus the green dots. And we see what your brain response looks like when you hear the beeps versus the boops. And so the targets versus like the background noise. And coming from a music background, well, coming from a little more in the world background, I thought like, this isn't what we see in the regular world. You know, we don't decide on green dots and red dots. We don't decide on beeps and boops, but we do listen to music. Some of us, a lot of us. So I came up with my first attempt to figure out what the hell was going on in neuroscience was to do this music experiment where we made the equivalent of beeps and boops, but it was, you're listening to, you know, any piece that you'd recognize from the radio. Bruce Springsteen song we used Eye of the Tiger by Survivor. And as you're listening to the piece, we made the key change abruptly. So it's a technique that's sometimes used in pop recordings to advantage, to like kind of get you attending to something. But in this case, it was like you're building an expectation about how the song's going to go, right? So if it's like, you know, Eye of the Tiger, right? Rising up, right? That song. And so what we would do is then change the key. So it's like, rising up, right? And so you're expecting what's going to happen next, right? But because that doesn't happen, your brain hears that and it goes, wow, what's that, right? And the interesting thing is that image of wow, right, is different for musicians than it is for non-musicians, right? A musician's brain is like, wow, right? Whereas a regular person's is just wow, right? And so that's just like the colloquial expression of a lot of neuroscience right there. But we measured that with EEG. And I wasn't doing this with Jordan at the time. I was doing this with another partner in the lab who also was kind of coming from outside neuroscience. And I presented this work in our lab meetings. We only had like 4 to 5 people at a time in the lab. And so it's a very small group. And, you know, pretty informal presentation. This is what I've been working on. Eye of the Tiger. And Jordan, after the meeting, comes to me and he says, keep in mind, we'd only talked about like baseball up to this point in time because I joined the lab in the fall of 2010. And, you know, he's a Yankees fan. I'm a Cubs fan. So they were still playing and we weren't. Usually the case with the Cubs. And so that aside, I was still willing to talk to him. And he said, do you think we do this with athletes? And I thought like, yeah, sure. You know, why not? I don't really know, but I figured why not? And so that was the genesis really of our first experiment, looking at how time pressure decision-making happens in baseball. That was really the basis for DeCervo later on. And so we applied the principle of, you know, the wah detection in music to recognizing whether it's a curveball or a fastball or in the zone or out of the zone. Same kind of quick decisions that you have to make, right? Or they happen that quickly. You don't have to decide that it's a key change, but you do have to recognize as a musician if you're going out of tune. And that happens, you know, as a series of quick decisions. And so that concept of quick decision making and how it's mediated by certain parts of the brain is really the core nugget idea of DeCervo. And you know, what we do is we improve decisions, quick ones in particular. You know, cute story about DeCervo in terms of the name of it. The spelling is kind of an Americanized version, Americanized English version of the, you know, French or Latin Romance language. In French, you would say DeCervo of the brain. And decisions, DeCervo, decisions, DeCervo. And so we thought this is a cool alliteration for it. And at the time, we live in New York City. And for some reason, I just keep running into French people in New York. And one of them was a woman I was dating at the time. And so I'm asking, what are we going to call this thing? She says, well, you know, the brain, DeCervo. cerveau in French. And then Jordan actually has a little connection to French culture too. He had lived in southeastern France for a while in Perpignan. So I ran it by him. I was like, what do you think? And so that's how we came up with the name De Cervo. We do decisions. We're doing that, you know, we're looking at how they happen in the brain. And so that's really where it all came from. And, you know, how we got to here, a lot of improvising. So that's probably the summary of De Cervo there.
That's awesome. Those are awesome stories. I was curious about how you came to the name, and it all makes sense. Based on what you told me. As somebody who's used the app a little bit, I don't think people realize just how difficult it is to make snap decisions. I think the best score I got on the app was maybe 50% at identifying what pitch was going to be coming. So it really is a really difficult thing to do. And when you look at performance athletes, they're doing something that, you know, probably 99.9% of the human population can't do at that level. But I wanted to follow up on something you said in your answer there. As somebody who was outside of neuroscience when you decided to get into it, and some of your partners were as well, how important do you think it was to be an outsider looking at this type of a thing? Like, did it help you with your point of view looking at it? Did it help your intellectual curiosity to be somebody who hadn't been studying this field for so long?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's a good point about the outsider thing, because I think, like, over time, I've heard this phrase on other podcasts about audience capture, you know, kind of how, like, you have to be like what the audience expects you to be. And it's like a kind of a similar problem to what you have in research and in academic research in particular, that, you know, you have to carve out what you're going to work on, your little slice of knowledge, and only be there. And I'm pretty bad at that. You know, I mean, I mentioned that I came from aerospace engineering. Before that, I came from physics. Before that, I was also a music major. And so, you know, having those various layers of perspective, I think were incredibly important. If I hadn't grown up playing the piano and writing music and playing music and listening to it and analyzing it, trying to understand it, I never would have come up with Eye of the Tiger, right, for a neuroscience experiment. I'd be doing red dots and green dots, which are fine, right? There's a lot of things you can do with red dots and green dots and beeps and boops. But this angle of figuring out what in the world is like red dots and green dots and what in the world is like beeps and boops, I think had a much better chance of happening because, you know, I play Bach and Beethoven, right? Or I produce music in Ableton. And so that outsider perspective, I think, is incredibly important. And, you know, I know that's particularly a theme with this podcast and, you know, the initiative that you guys are doing at the Army. And I think it's, you know, it's something that the Army has benefited from for, you know, over 200 years, an outsider perspective. You know, you go back to Kosciuszko and Pulaski, right? Those are outsiders. And, you know, now it's obviously a lot more institutionalized, but, you know, there's also a limiting factor, I think, for, you know, a 200 plus year successful endeavor like the Army in terms of its kind of bureaucratic structure. I'm not saying bureaucratic is a bad thing. It's just, that's the way it functions. But a small business like De Cervo, which has only been around for 8 years instead of 220 plus, operates differently. And the real challenge is, how shall the two meet, right? How shall the two interact with one another? Not just De Cervo, but other nimble outside perspective entities, right? And that's why I think, you know, this having this conversation, making it happen on a podcast kind of setting and, you know, other events that you guys are running, I think is a very important thing that you guys are doing right now.
Well, thank you, Jason. That's a phenomenal answer, because I think that lines up with what we try to do, as you said, with the program. Army Mad Scientist, we always say we're trying to harness the intellect of the nation. So we don't want to just talk to the Army and military thought leaders, but really get outside of that. And one of my favorite books, David Epstein's Range, really talks a lot about the analogous learning and the insights that you get from people who aren't, you know, considered necessarily the subject matter experts in certain niche areas. So I want to, and also Matt might hit 50% on the app. Me not being a huge baseball fan will probably hit, you know, I'll be lucky to break 10%. But I want to dive a little bit into the science behind how your system works now. I'm sure people are extremely curious about the brain helmets. What can you tell us about how it measures decision making and what those measurements mean?
Well, first on the app scores that you guys mentioned. So we're talking about the U-Hit baseball app, I think here, right? And Matt, if you were doing 50%, you were basically guessing. Luke, if you were getting 10%, then you were guessing a lot of times wrong, which means you have a good chance of being right at some point. Because we're that accuracy measurement there is, I think, it's a great segue into, you know, what we measure and how the science of it works. Is accuracy is a colloquial expression for that we've, you know, we've decided to give it because nobody knows what an area under the ROC curve means in dugouts around the country, right? And area under the ROC curve, you know, for people who come from a background in behavioral science and things like that, is a much better measurement of how well you're discriminating between beeps and boops or red dots and green dots. In this case, fastballs and curveballs and sliders and in the zone and out of the zone. So whenever you're getting close to 50% as a player on U-Hit, that's our indication that you're guessing. And so when we do this all the time, we look at players' numbers. Working right now with one of the Texas major league teams, we work on the development side. And we have players, we work with a lot of players actually that are Spanish speakers natively. And there is a language component to using an application. And particularly in the pitch recognition version of U-Hit, you see some text that says fastball, curveball, slider. And then you got to decide if the pitch that comes is a fastball, curveball, or slider, right? Does it match to what that text was? And you got to do it while the pitch is coming at you. And, you know, whenever we see that a player is right around 50% on accuracy on the app, that tells us they're guessing, that there's something about the game they're not getting. Maybe it's the language, you know, that's in a foreign language to them, or that however they're just doing it. So I have hope for you, Luke, that you will be a great hitter. Matt, I don't know, 50%, we're going to have to work on that.
If 50% truly is guessing, that explains the stall out in my baseball career.
You could have been in on the performance cortex, you know, book too, right? It's not just limited to Jewish kids. So the science behind it. Yeah. I mean, I think that's that look at the U-Hit app. You know, we make many apps. We make for baseball hitters, softball hitters. So all, you know, those are both on the app store. We make a hockey officials training app that is limited to the league that uses that and the leagues that they want us to work with. So we'll be starting actually working with couple of the minor leagues of hockey, the East Coast Hockey League, ECHL, and the American Hockey League, the AHL, pretty soon this season. Major League Baseball had hired us to make an app for their umpires to call balls and strikes better. Shockingly, they think they're perfect, so they didn't actually end up using the thing. So, as many Yankees fans will attest from this week's events in the AL Championship Series. But using apps to measure, you know, neural ability is really just a way of getting it out to the most people possible, which is really kind of an imperative when you're in a business setting. And but we get the ability to measure how the nervous system is working in all of those applications: baseball, softball, hitting, calling balls and strikes, right? How did the placement of the catcher, the framing of the catcher, impact your call, right? And how you measure that. Right. So it's all about a careful balance between how you probe the nervous system and how you measure it. Right. And, you know, beeps and boops, EEG and MRI, red dots, green dots, EEG and MRI. Right. You can do red dots and green dots on an app too, but there isn't really an application anybody really cares about enough to be able to discriminate red dots and green dots. So when we've boiled down the science of hitting a baseball to tapping on a screen on an iPhone, it's because most people don't want to stick their head in an MRI machine or put a EEG cap on their head and wait for the sensors to get, you know, the right saturation and right signal quality and all that kind of stuff. So we have to work with the way decisions are made naturally in the environment And then what is the most operationally robust way of measuring those decisions? And for most baseball players, most softball players, it's doing it through an iPhone or an iPad. You know, we thought that major league hitters, there's so much money involved. There's so much at stake financially. So we're thinking like, of course they'd put on an EEG cap, right? To figure out how to hit a curveball better. The answer is no, they won't. And actually the minor league players are much more, I think, accepting of using an application on your phone to hit better than the veterans are. And this is a general trend that we see across all sports, all applications, whether it's law enforcement or other sports like baseball, softball, umpires, officials, is that the phone is a good avenue for measuring decision-making, but still there are a lot of people that don't want to engage with it. And so that unfortunately has really put the initial scientific underpinnings of DeServo to the side in many cases, meaning imaging brain activity with, you know, EEG helmets and MRIs and things like that, because it's just, it's not feasible in terms of a cultural thing, right? It's kind of like in 2019, meeting by Zoom was what you did if you were too cheap to go and travel to meet somebody, right? Now everybody does it. It's culturally, we've changed. We were locked indoors for a year, so, you know, still wanted to talk to people, and this was the only way. And so same thing with, I think, with measuring brain activity during quick decisions. It's a function of what kind of access you have culturally. And really the science of how DeServo's, you know, measurements of your ability and training of your ability works are based on this match between how you represent and show what the real world is like, and then how you measure what the brain's perception of that simulated world is like. And so when it comes to, you know, baseball hitting, for instance, you hit is measuring how quickly you can tap on a screen as a ball's coming to the plate, whether it's going to be in the zone or out of the zone, whether it's matching the cue that you got before the pitch. If it's going to be a curveball and you see a curveball, you tap as quickly as possible. If you see a curveball's coming and then a slider's actually thrown, you got to hold off on that. You don't tap the screen. And when you're measuring that through a phone, you can only measure whether you tapped and how quickly you tapped, right? So from that, you can measure accuracy. You can measure reaction time, response time to the pitch. When you're measuring that while also wearing EEG or you're in an MRI machine, you've got a whole bunch of other things you can look at. Because you can look at, with an EEG, for instance, you can look at how quickly you recognize that's a curveball, which is also kind of measured when you tap the screen, if it's a match. But what you can't do without EEG is measure how quickly you decided it was a slider when you were cued that it was a curveball. You can't measure that when you didn't tap. The phone doesn't know when you decided not to tap on it. Only it knows when you tapped on it. But the EEG, from EEG and the processing that we, you know, we've done on that kind of data, you can tell when the brain decides not to tap. And so that, what they call an inhibitory response, is something that is very important, actually, to the science behind anything DeServo does, because it tells us how good your BS detector is, right? Because that's really actually an expert signal, right? You know what to expect. Rising up, right? You know what to expect next. But when your BS detector goes off in your brain, that's an expert signal in your brain. And that's a signal that's informed by a lot of experience. And you can measure that in the brain with the EEG. You can't measure it without the tap. You know, you see something's BS on screen, you just go past it. You're like, that's crap. So that's really, I think, a good way to describe overall what DeServo does. And it manifests in various ways, right? Whether it's recognizing fastballs, curveballs, sliders in the zone, out of the zone, whether it's calling slashing or icing, right? Icing is still a mystery to me. I don't understand it. It's like, well, I don't know, the puck's down there and sometimes it's an icing and sometimes it's not. But law enforcement, you know, is a new area we're getting into where you're not just making snap decisions all the time, but you're thinking about how this situation is that I'm encountering with somebody getting off a bus and I have to search them, how does the Fourth Amendment apply here? Right? Now they're going in an ambulance. Oh, how does that change things? Right? It does. And so I think, you know, as we get into more application of areas that are usually thought of as deliberate decisions, applying the law, for instance, right? We're starting to see that deliberate decisions are in some regards a series of quick decisions. So, you know, it's not all hitting a baseball, but it's a series of hitting a baseball type decisions leading up to the overall bigger decision. And those are areas that I'm pretty excited to see how that science, that underlying science of balancing what you show versus how you measure the nervous system can lead us into all sorts of areas of performance improvement that have generally been off limits until now.
No, I think that's a fantastic answer and really helps us understand the importance between what's showing and what's being measured. So I think that's really interesting. I kind of had a two-parter follow-up, really. One being, you were talking about with the app and Matt, as we have slammed on him plenty, got 50%, you know, accuracy. So he's guessing. What do you think the connection is when we talked previously regarding the performance cortex? One of the things that was noted was the connection between movement and then the cognitive decision making that came through that. So, you know, do you see sometimes that connection where he might struggle somewhat on the app, but put Matt in a batter's box, put him you know, with the bat in his Bryce Harper stance, and suddenly he's gonna recognize it better because it's not pushing on an app, it's connected to the movement. I know muscle memory is not a real thing, but that neurological connection, does that impact it? And then additionally, what do you think about measuring when it comes to environmentals? So if somebody is overly tired, somebody is hungry, there is life implications that are really affecting them, even down to the weather. How do you, you know, account for those?
If Matt is guessing on a simulated version of pitches, he's probably going to be guessing on the real version of the pitches too. And he's going to have the added layer of not knowing where the pitches are going and being scared to death that one of these things is going to plunk him in the face. And that's actually a real thing for many, many younger players. You know, older players won't admit it, but they're also afraid of the ball. It hurts. I played base. It hurts when you get hit with the ball, but it hurts a lot more to be shot or killed, you know? So clearly there's a whole other level of fear that is involved in, let's say, army soldier decisions or law enforcement decisions and how you process what you see and hear and feel and things like that in those environments are going to be different because of that layer of neurotransmitter activity. And you know, you have parts in your brain that are more towards the interior of the brain that mediate strong emotion type, you know, decision making. And actually I just came back from a International Chief of Police conference in Dallas, and all the law enforcement's there and from all over the world, really. And when I talked to chiefs of police there, I explained to them, you know, we always want to say, like, you know, don't be emotional with decision making, but I try to explain to them, like, all decisions are emotional. Right, whether you want it or not. You might, you know, have reasons for why you did X, Y, and Z, but those are usually coming after the fact. And there is an emotional component to pretty much every decision you make. And we see that on the brain level. Like when we did EEG and simultaneous fMRI measurements of baseball hitters, they're deciding to swing at pitches with the putamen, which is this thing all the way in the interior of the brain, and is, you know, is involved with all sorts of, you know, emotional type things. And other subcortical structures are involved in these decisions too. And so with the musicians, I'll give a brief story on that. One of the neat things when musicians are listening to a piece of music that they've played before. So not Survivor listening to them play Eye of the Tiger, right? But I'm talking about cellists listening to a Bach cello suite that like everybody, you know, in the planet has heard. Right? It's on like Lexus commercials and stuff like that. When a cellist who's played that like a zillion times, right, hears that piece of music and it's right, all of a sudden the key change, their brain, when it goes, wah, right, because it does wah, not wah, right, what the non-musicians would do, when their brain, you know, reacts to that key change, it reacts that way because those deep down centers of movement, subcortical, closer to the emotional level, right? Deep brain stimulation is something actually that's used to cure things like Parkinson's, right? Movement related problems. And when those deep down centers that have been honed over years of playing that piece recognize a conflict between what they're expecting to hear, they shoot that up to the upper levels of the brain, the movement areas that are on top of the brain. And we measure that with the EEG. And that's one big component of the that the musical brains make versus the non-musical brains, right? Because the musical brains are expecting that movement sequence to happen from what they're hearing because they've done it themselves. And so this is a, you know, an important element to any kind of decision making is the interaction between these subcortical structures and the cortical structures. Zach talked about the performance cortex, right? But it's not just the cortex, the cerebral cortex, the curly stuff on the outside that's important. It's how that stuff works with the interior stuff, the putamen and the amygdala, the cerebellum, and then how those things innervate the rest of the body and the nervous system, right? One thing I went to Columbia after finishing a PhD because I wanted to learn more about the brain. When I left Columbia, well, actually pretty soon after starting there and, you know, working there, I realized it's not just about the brain. It's how the brain is situated in a body. And you're not going to understand the brain unless you understand how it's relating to the body and how it's connected to the body. So it's not by chance really that I stumbled on musicians, right? Because as the first area to go to, because they're all about connection to the body, right? You got to know what your body is doing every instant and on different instant levels, right? Tens of milliseconds, hundreds of milliseconds, thousands of milliseconds, right? And you have to know how that's interacting with what you're hearing and feeling vibrations of. Same thing as a hitter, you have to know on a gut level, this is a good pitch, this is not a good pitch. And those subcortical structures are very important aspects of that inhibit movement that we were talking about before. And the BS detection that we talked about before, because you know on a gut level, like, you know, that something's wrong here, right? Remember, that's the wah, right? And so that component is going to be different when you are watching a role play of a robbery happen and when you are watching an actual body cam video of a role play happen. When you hear exactly the type of things someone says in those situations, you see the exact type of things that people do in those situations, and you have to interact with that type of environment. And so because there will be a fear component to it, there will be a like kind of a pain aspect potentially, right? Hit by a baseball, hit with a bullet, right? Those subcortical structures are going to be acting a little differently. And this is actually something we talk about regularly with law enforcement when they look at our product, E-Train. You know, there's a lot of use of virtual reality in law enforcement now and in baseball, other sports too. And the predominant way that virtual reality is used is by simulating the world with avatars and things like that, but also with like reenactments with actors. And so you can move your head around the whole space and, you know, you turn this way and you see one person, you turn that way, you see another person. But you know, deep down on a gut level that this is a reenactment, right? And this person is acting like a criminal. They're not really a criminal, right? When you watch a body cam video of a real interaction on the news, That's the real deal, right? And so that is stimulating a different level of fear and, you know, possibility of injury and all the other emotions that are involved than just watching a reenactment. And, you know, Hollywood movies are great at that, you know, simulating that kind of level of excitement in a scene. But there's nothing like the real deal situation, because for people who've been in those environments, it sets off all sorts of bells for them in terms of what to attend to and what not to attend to. And so that's why we, you know, we try to make our simulations as realistic as possible, but like we don't really get into the fidelity trap, is what I call it, right? Just because you're spending $10 million on a virtual reality simulator doesn't mean you're going to be better at measuring decisions. You can measure decisions pretty well. Like, we've done it with baseball hitters for 10 years almost, with a video game on the phone. That's what UHIT is. Looks like a video game, right? But that video game is able to race on base and slugging percentages hundreds of players so far. Tens of thousands of people have used UHIT, but it's usually they just try out a few pitches and 50% and they're out of here. But the, you know, college and professional players that use it regularly know that how we analyze the data and give them a custom training program next, they know they can rely on that seeming video game to have a transference out to the real world, because they're seeing it there and we're measuring it too. And so I think the movement aspect, coming back to that, is really a broader question about how the interior parts of the brain are also brought to bear, and that the movement of swinging a bat is not necessarily, well, it's not at all similar to tapping on a phone. But if you can't tap on the phone at the right time when you're seeing simulations of the same pitches you're going to see when you're holding the real bat, looking at the real pitches, it's not going
to
happen.
So before we move on, allow me to defend my 50%. You can be a standout in the Pensacon Youth Athletic Association's Babe Ruth Baseball League by guessing on pitches as a 16-year-old. Because if you get into an 0-2 count, it's going to be a curveball every single time. So let me put that out there. It doesn't work once you get past that level, obviously.
I will be directing all Major League Scouts your data very soon now, Matt.
Thank you. So we had been talking about law enforcement. You'd mentioned it a few times now. That concept is more closely tied to the military than maybe some of the sports ones are. With that being said, do you see, or how do you see, your technology potentially being used to train Army soldiers to make quicker and better decisions? Is that something you think could be translated from sports and law enforcement over to the military?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up law enforcement. I mean, I know we've touched on it here and there. And, you know, our police training product, E-Train, you know, while I was at IACP, the Chief of Police Conference, you know, I talked to a lot of law enforcement about training in that environment. And then many of the current law enforcement are former military, right? And as much as the baseball analogy they get right away, they also get it from their former lives in military, whether it's an Army or, you know, other branches. So I think yes is the short answer for Army soldiers, and really, you know, anyone in the overall organization of the Army. These are things that we've been trying to do for, let's see, the last 6 years, I think now, 7 years. Some examples: turret gunners. You're on top of a tank. There's a turret up there. There's a gun. You swivel around. And you got to decide target, non-target. Is that a kid or is that somebody with an IED? And so that's target detection, beeps and boops. Effective human teaming and social sensing. This is something that ARL, HRED, Human Research Engineering Directorate, is hot on these days, human teaming and stuff like that. We had an idea to do that actually within the hockey official world, because we're doing remote sensing in terms of the behavioral ability to make visual search type decisions. You have 2 or 4 man configurations, person configurations. There are actually a lot of female officials. And So you have these 2 or 4 person configurations, and you have to like figure out where you're going to go on the ice in relation to other people on the ice so that you've got a good view of, you know, the mysterious icing calls versus the, you know, the plays at the net where the puck happens to be. And so that's a teaming kind of environment, right? But how well you recognize something leading up to a slashing play or a boarding call or whatever is going to impact where you go on the ice and how you pick your positioning. So our idea was, let's look at human teaming in this environment because we've got social sensing in terms of the app that all these officials are using. And let's, you know, use this sandbox to look at how it works in a combat vehicle environment, right? In a turret gunner environment, interacting with a driver, in other kind of team environments that you see. When I worked with ARL, I hosted a joint fellowship for my second year at Columbia between Columbia and Army Research Lab. So I'd spent a lot of time down at the Aberdeen Proving Ground. And one of the people I met there, she was actually from Fort Sam Houston, working with the medical triage teams and training them and stuff. And she was really into mindfulness, meditation, things like that, which, you know, meditation, brains, okay, there's some overlap there. And we had this idea that we could apply some like ways of measuring how the brain as a whole works. We call it like network neuroscience. Doing that, applying some techniques for measuring how the whole brain works to like medical triage people doing meditation and then how that impacts their ability to make decisions on like triaging severity of cases. And, you know, it's basically a visual recognition thing. I'm going to attend to this gunshot wound now and that one later, right? Because this one's in the leg and this one's in the chest, or vice versa, right? And so that was an interesting idea. And it actually has some very strong basis in how we looked at baseball hitters' brains and the research, the published, you know, peer-reviewed research that's on the background of DeSerfo. Because we looked at how the, you know, remember we talked about the putamen being a fundamental part of deciding to swing at a pitch in the zone. But it's not just the putamen. It's how the putamen links up to the, you know, the visual areas and links up to the motor areas that are outside, the, you know, like on the outer layer of the brain and on the inner layer of the brain. So those networks change as a function of how accurately you're doing the task, how good you're feeling that day, things like that. And maybe even how well you meditate or if you meditate, right? And so that's been a topic that, you know, we think can be helpful for soldiers. But there are a lot of ways that decision-making for soldiers, for, you know, personnel who are making other kinds of decisions on a quick level can benefit from. The biggest challenge really for us has been like, why not? And I think it really goes back to the difference between a large organization that's been around for 226 years and a small organization that's been around for 8. And it's very difficult for some reason for those two entities to function together. And I know there are small businesses that do all sorts of great things for the Army. But so far that's been a pain point, big time frustration point. And, you know, I think having discussions like this to be able to, you know, figure out like, all right, we've got this need here. Why isn't it being met? Is fruitful to talk about in such an environment like this. If the Texas Rangers come to us and say, we need to improve our hitters tomorrow, right? Today's Tuesday. We need this on Wednesday, right? They send the money that quickly, right? The Army maybe sends it to you 18 months later, or they send you an answer about if they will send the money 18 months later, right? Small businesses don't do that. We just can't operate on that kind of time frame. So I think as much as it's important to talk about the ways that DeSerfo and our approaches to decision-making can help soldiers, the fact so far is that really we haven't. And it's a shame. But, you know, the underlying application of how do you make quick decisions better, I think is there. And it's malleable to the operational context. And so we just need a framework that's open to that kind of malleability. And I think that's probably the next step.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a good segue. You know, how do you see your system really evolving when it comes to some of the aspects of real-time decision-making? And when we look at things like mental or cognitive augmentation, and then also the idea of cognitive enhancement through whether it be chemical enhancement, or whether it also just be certain training aspects that you realize you can improve this. So it's not just the measurement aspect, but really tying it to augmentation and real-time performance enhancement.
Yeah, there are things out there, you know, in terms of like, you know, take this pill, brain boost and stuff like that. But the work that the servo does is, I think, better described instead of like, you know, popping the DeServo pill, it's more like getting the cliff notes on how to do your job better, I think is the best way to describe it. Because one thing I've noticed with DeServo over time is we became less of a neuroscience company and more of a kind of like an educational company on some level. Like we're teaching people how to do things. My father was a professor and a rabbi, which means teacher. My mother is she's a lawyer, so she gets paid to yell at people, but she's also a law professor, so she gets paid to yell at her students also. So I think that aspect is so important in terms of what the servos become over the last 8 years is, you know, we've had to really figure out how to communicate better. Being on podcasts is part of that, right? But also explaining to you in the app what it means when you score 50% on accuracy, pitch recognition, and what do you do next? And so on that level, it's real time, but that's not real time like you put on the visor in the gunner turret and now your targets are highlighted green and your, you know, kids that you're not supposed to shoot are, you know, overlaid with red. That's a different kind of real time. But you always are running into the problem of just adding too much stuff up there on the screen and overloading the pilot, the gunner, or the user, whoever it is. But I think the real-time decision-making is, like, you wouldn't do it in baseball, right? Because there is no overlay you're allowed to use. But the turret gunner, right? He or she who's up in the turret there, I mean, you know, they could have a visor down that's, you know, feeding them information and stuff like that. What if that information was not just driven by what's outside them, but what's inside them, right? How well they're seeing targets right now and how salient you have to make a target look or whatever. Maybe you change the contrast on the lens a certain way because today I'm recognizing targets better than I was yesterday, right? So make targets look more salient or something. I think our system is evolving. I mean, we're going into, there's so many different areas you can go in with fast decision making. And so, you know, baseball and softball is where we began. You know, hockey for officiating, you know, is somewhat where we continued next. Police, I think, is another area. You know, the way law is applied in New York State is sometimes different than how it's applied in Florida. And we have to be able to adapt to those different constraints of how law is applied. So that's actually a huge area. Is, you know, how do we start bridging the gap to more traditionally deliberatively thought decisions, right? Prosecuting, laying out litigation arguments, things like that, but doing that in the course of a half a second, right? I apply the Fourth Amendment here, I don't apply it there, right? I see a weapon being drawn, I do this versus that if I'm in New York State or in New York City or I'm in Florida. Those are things that are, you know, pretty front burner, but we're up for it. We're excited for it. This is really kind of a completion of a vision that one of our mentors had for us. His name is David Stern. He was the commissioner of the NBA for many years. I was fortunate enough to meet him once in New York and called upon him to, you know, give us some advice. And he was kind enough to meet with me and my partner, Jordan. And I kind of called him our rabbi of sports marketing, because he knew everything about sports and marketing and communication, and just the business. And it was sad when he passed away right before COVID. And but he had this vision about, you know, referees, and says, forget about the players. We need this with the referees. And although it didn't catch on communication once again with the NBA. It caught on elsewhere. And, you know, but that topic of, you know, visual search and being on the lookout kind of a century, right? And then being able to recognize and decide something, that's incredibly important for, you know, for military, particularly for the Army. So, you know, I think as those things develop, you know, for referees, and other areas like that, it's going to be able to have positive spin on effects back to the Army too. So I think all those things are really front burner for us right now in terms of where we're going. And, you know, we're excited to see where things go next.
Jason, that's really fantastic stuff. And just a couple points I'll pull out to highlight, you know, the decision-making aspect of identifying threats that you made mention of, especially with, you know, gun turret operators, but also the rules of engagement stuff. So you talked about for law enforcement, you know, for them, it was more about the changing environment and what decisions would they make based on what laws they could apply. You know, I can see sort of a parallel there for soldiers in terms of, all right, what's the environment here? What are my rules of engagement? And finally, the explainability aspect of it, because I think that goes towards trust by the user in the system. So there's a lot of things that we've seen in terms of emerging technologies where maybe the user doesn't feel confident because they don't know why the system is giving them the response that it's giving them, and therefore they don't trust it. But the explainability aspect fosters that sort of trustworthiness between the individual user and the system. So I think those are all those three things there jive with what we've been seeing when we talk to innovators and we've been discovering emerging tech. So at this point, we're going to transition to our rapid fire questions now. So the hard part's over. Now we get into the questions. We ask these to all of our guests. They're always the same. We throw it at you. You come back with your first response. I did give Zach a different question. And I'll give that same one to you just to keep the playing field even here. So first question is, what technology or trend keeps you up at night?
Ad-driven content.
And why is that? I'll give you a little bit of leeway here to explain.
We'll take podcasts as a counterexample to that, right? We're the counterexample to the bite-sized interviews. I mean, I've done a bunch of these at this point. DeSoto was a cool idea at the time. Brains, baseball, that kind of stuff, right? So I've experienced it both sides. And, you know, and now you really can see it a lot easier empirically with social media. There are these bubbles of activity in terms of, you know, types of content and themes of content, which is fueled a lot of the time by advertising priority. And because advertising is a function of how well you meet a product or a service with a buyer, you need to understand something about the product or service and something about the buyer. And, you know, I think content delivered on devices like phones and tablets and web browsers are, you know, they're collecting a ton of information about how you interact, right? They're collecting a lot of the behavioral information, actually. How much you scrolled, how much you swiped, how long you looked at a video before you swiped. And so I'm not saying whether that information is good or bad to collect. It's just, it is collected. But I think the ad-driven aspect of how content is prioritized to some people versus other people creates information bubbles. And that means understanding bubbles. Which eventually keeps people from interacting with one another because their information bubble is not overlapping with another person's information bubble.
Second question, what's something about you that most people might not know that you're willing to share with us here on the podcast?
Well, I think I hinted at that earlier. I'm a music producer, pianist, and because I produce electronic music, I've become a DJ over the last few years. So that I can play my music out. So my DJ name is Shredder Thor. Shredder, because I love the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I always thought the Shredder helmet was like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And one of my you know, electronic music inspirations is Deadmau5, and he's got like this helmet that, you know, he wears on stage. So I was thinking, like, all right, what's a good like kind of helmet fixture. So that's on Spotify and you know, Apple Music and whatever. If you look up my music there, Shredder Thor, and you know, and I record piano music that I either write or record others, you know, Bach, Schubert, those kind of guys. So yeah, that's all, you know, from my website and whatever. But most people don't know about that. I don't talk about that much with the servo, even though that's somewhat related to the origins of, you know, how we started looking at musicians listening to Bach cello suites and Survivor.
All right. So between electronic music and classical music, I was going to ask you to start a band with me, but I don't think our overlap is going to happen anywhere there.
You can call it the 50%.
I'm never going to live this down. I'm going to start practicing, and I'm going to text you screenshots every time it goes above 50%.
I want to see that. Right. I want to see that.
So final question, although I am going to have a follow on to it. What's your favorite movie?
Right now, it's always a right now thing. True Lies. I just watched True Lies recently, and I just think it's like so funny and good. I mean, James Cameron is just like a massive, a lot of people don't know it's James Cameron, like Titanic, James Cameron, Avatar, James Cameron.
I'll be honest. I didn't realize it was a James Cameron film. I like a lot of James Cameron's movies. I think The Abyss is probably underrated. For some reason I've gravitated towards that one. But I don't think you can do better than Terminator and Aliens and Terminator 2. So those always get the fanfare, and deservedly so.
Right. Yeah. But True Lies, it's, you know, it's under the radar there.
Yeah. Yeah. So the follow-up to that question, this is what I asked Zach as well. Who's your favorite? For him, it was really baseball player, but I'll open up to, who's your favorite sports athlete of all time? I'll try to guess in my head, because you already said you were a Cubs fan, so I'll think in my head who I think it might be, but go ahead and answer.
You know, as much as I grew up in Wrigley Field, I would say Michael Jordan. Like, if anybody I would want to meet, it's Michael Jordan.
Okay.
It's, you know, his story about, like, you know, just, you know, I don't know, his, just his, everything about him. You know, how he played. I mean, he was like poetry in motion.
Yeah. In retrospect, I think that is the obvious answer for you. I had my head in baseball.
Who did you have?
Well,
you
so I'm thinking Cubs, and I wasn't exactly sure when your, you know, coming of age was with baseball, but I had, you know, Ryne Sandberg, Andre Dawson, maybe Ron Santo, one of those types in there.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. Funny story with Ryne Sandberg. I never met. He was my first favorite baseball player, though. I will say that. Dawson was, I was 3 or 4 years old when he was the MVP. And I was a huge fan. I'm still a huge fan of Andre Dawson. He's a great guy. And funny story with him. So towards the end of his career, he was playing for the Florida Marlins. And before they were the Miami Marlins, they were still the Florida Marlins. And they had, on one year, they had like everybody great on their team. They didn't win, but they were great. It was like 96 or something like that. They had him. They had, like, you know, I think Piazza was.
He was there for a short window of time. Yeah, it was a weird thing. Yeah.
Yeah, weird thing. He was there. There were a lot of people on this team at the time. Kevin Brown was there. And so Dawson was at the end of his career. I went to a lot of Cubs games growing up. I went to Bulls games. So we had this habit of stalking the players coming and going from games so that we could get autographs, right? I met so many players. I got some great stories meeting the Washington Bullets that way and all this stuff. But we were stalking the Marlins when they were in town to play the Cubs. And actually, it was my friend, Drew, who is a very successful lawyer now, actually advised me quite a bit on E-Train, because he had worked with the Chicago police. He had done some moonlighting with them going on ride-alongs in Englewood, which is a very rough neighborhood in the south side of Chicago. And Drew grew up across the street from the Westin Hotel in a building known as the John Hancock Building. It's a skyscraper in Chicago that a lot of people know, that is X's on the side of the building. And because he grew up across the street from the Westin, because we had this habit of stalking baseball players, one day he was just, you know, throwing a baseball against the side of the John Hancock Building, playing catch with yourself, right? Because that's what kids do. And Al Leiter, who was with the Florida Marlins at the time, great pitcher, he comes out, says, "Hey, you want to have a catch?" And so he was on that team at the time in 96. And Al Leiter made it so that we could hang out after all the fans left the stadium that day. behind the dugout. And then we could meet them as they were getting out of the bus to go back to their hotel. And so I'm ready for this, right? I've got my jerseys, I've got my baseballs, I've got a pen for the baseballs, I've got a regular ballpointing pen for the baseballs, and I've got a those felt markers, like a silver felt marker is the best for signing jerseys. And I'm really excited. I mean, Andre Dawson, I mean, this guy I grew up watching. And, they're getting on the bus. They're walking by. Andre Dawson is wearing a green and white checkered suit. I mean, it's like the Joker, the suit. Clearly expensive. And I got my baseballs and my pens and my markers. And the silver marker is out with the pen cap off. And Andre Dawson backs up in his green and white checker suit into the silver marker. And there is a streak, silver streak, an unexpected autograph from me on his green and white checker suit. And I don't think to this day he knows where that streak came from. And I really hope he doesn't listen to the Mad Scientist podcast. But I did end up getting an autograph from him on a shirt of my choosing. He's a great guy, Andre Dawson.
Well, we would be honored if the Hawk did listen to our podcast, but I think the chances are infinitesimal that this episode will reach his doorstep. So I think you're safe there.
I'm going to see if my surrogate grandmother can make that happen.
There we go.
See if Susan can make that happen. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're willing to let the story out of the silver streak on the green suit, then by all means.
I'm hoping at this point, yeah, it's like one of those, statute of limitations things, especially if I was a juvenile at the time.
Right. Yeah. We can get that expunged. Well, Jason, this has been an awesome conversation. First and foremost, super fun to talk to you, but more importantly, very informative for what the Army can start thinking about in terms of decision making and how the brain works. So I want to thank you for coming on the show today and for talking to us and, explaining your system and explaining how your technology works and helping us learn a little bit more about how we can train soldiers better.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guest, Jason Sherwin, CEO and co-founder of DeServo, for talking with us. You can connect with Mad Scientist through Twitter at @ArmyMadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to our blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps us to improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.